Greetings, welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a wonderful show for you. We have a playwright, author, historian, journalist, commentator, and political actor. It's going to be our great pleasure today to be joined by Tariq Ali. But first, before we go to today's show, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Federal Communications Commission came under heavy fire last week at a hearing in Washington, D.C. on media consolidation and its effect on local programming. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin wants to change the rules to allow giant corporations like Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, GE, and Disney to own even more of our local media outlets. And he's in a hurry. According to press reports, Martin wants to gut longstanding limits as soon as December.
Martin waited until the last possible minute allowed by law to announce the hearing that was scheduled for 9 a.m. on Halloween, a day many people wouldn't be able to attend. Despite the late notice, 150 people showed up at FCC headquarters for a rally before the hearing. Among them was New York Congressman Maurice Hinchey.
We've got to ensure that we have an information distribution system in America that is open, that is fair, and that is full of diversity and opinion, so that the people of our country can make the decisions themselves based upon a complete availability of all information.
Say, stop big media!
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 That's community organizer and hip-hop activist Reverend Lennox Yearwood firing up the crowd.
This is one of the most critical issues of our time. We understand that this is really a moment. If they control our media, they control our message.
Inside the official FCC hearing, the topic was localism. Along with competition and diversity, localism is supposed to be one of the three main factors that underlies all of the Commission's media ownership rules. When the Commission last reviewed the rules in 2003, said FCC Chairman Kevin Martin, who was then a commissioner, many people expressed concern about the process.
The Commission committed to conducting this proceeding in a manner that was going to be open and transparent and that would allow for ample public participation. And I think that's what the Commission has done.
Commissioner Michael Copps disagreed with Martin. He warned the audience that they would hear a lot of nice words about localism, but he had no confidence that the commission would translate those words into good policy. Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein also had reservations about the chairman's intentions.
The important questions looming over the proceeding today are, will we do anything productive with what we've learned? We've been across the country. Will it lead to real changes in how we hold media outlets accountable to their local communities? Or was this entire proceeding just a chore to get done so media giants can have their way with even greater media consolidation?
The Reverend Jesse Jackson, founder of the Rainbow Push Coalition, said media ownership is a civil rights issue.
The city of Washington, people of color make up 72% of the population, but not a single TV station owned in D.C. is minority owned. If we want more diversity, consolidation is not the answer. Consolidation is the polar opposite of diversity. You can't have both.
Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, also testified.
There are numerous public interest benefits to increasing minority and women's ownership, including an increase in program diversity, a breakdown of stereotypes, better service for underrepresented segments of the population, increased civic participation, and not least, remedying past discrimination against women and minorities who were not included in the government's initial free handout of the broadcast spectrum.
The testimony that got the most interest from the commissioners came from S. Derek Turner, research director of Free Press. Turner said the commission's efforts to study data on female and minority ownership failed miserably. One study missed 67% of all minority-owned TV stations and a whopping 75% of the TV stations owned by women. Another study on people's media habits neglected to include a category for Latinos. Our nation's largest and fastest growing minority group was simply forgotten. Turner lambasted the commission.
You're faced with a choice. You can listen to the concerns of Wall Street, or you can listen to the concerns of Main Street. The public is tired of these companies using our airwaves as their personal ATMs. They want you to say no to more consolidation and say yes to local accountability, yes to diversity and ownership, and yes to the public interest.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're really privileged to have a wonderful guest on the show with us here at the station. Our guest, Tariq Ali, is author of numerous books, playwright, filmmaker, journalist. Most recently, he's the author of Pirates of the Caribbean, Conversations with Edward Said, Bush and Babylon, Clash of Fundamentalisms, and an update of his memoir from the 1960s, Street Fighting Years, all in the last 5 years, all really highly acclaimed books, extraordinary accomplishments, I think, frankly, are a testament to the fact that you have a cumulative knowledge, frankly, from a lifetime of activism and engagement, intellectual engagement and political engagement, that when you turn to a subject like Latin America, you don't start from scratch, but you start with a base that's quite significant that makes an analysis come to you somewhat easily. And well, welcome to the show, Tariq.
Very nice to be with you, Bob. Well, it helps having a past and not having abandoned it. And so when I was writing Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, I did recall my trips to Latin America in the 60s. In particular, the trip I made to Bolivia when Che Guevara was still alive and fighting 40 years ago this month. He was soon about to die. And I remember it was a very tense and harrowed trip because a group of us had gone from Britain, my colleagues Robin Blackburn and Perry Anderson from the New Left Review, and we were really half masquerading as being mainstream journalists. We had our papers, so we could get close to the arena of conflict and attend the trial of Régis Debray, the French intellectual who was tried for being a guerrilla. That's the first time I really encountered what I can call Creole racism in South America. They looked at me, and I had very long mustaches and long hair, and thought I was an Indian, a native, an indigenous person, and said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Pakistan." "Where's that?" They had no idea. So they were always suspicious of me, and then they arrested me on the charge that I was in fact a Cuban guerrilla called Pombo, who was Che Guevara's bodyguard. And finally, I have to say this. I mean, they kept me in...
These are the Bolivian
This
military.
Is the Bolivian military in a town called Cameri. And I said, well, if I was a Cuban guerrilla, just answer me this. How come I don't speak Spanish? And they said, well, you do speak Spanish, and you're just putting on this act. And I then, you know, being young and foolhardy, said, I'll do a deal with you guys. Why don't you torture me all night? And if in the morning, when I've recovered from the torture a bit, I can speak Spanish, I'll be grateful to you for the rest of my life. They didn't have a sense of humor, but...
sort of the advanced Berlitz program.
Yeah. And then the only reason they let me go was because there was a very decent New York Times journalist there covering the trial. And he told them, this guy is not a Cuban, I can just tell you that. and he'd sent a dispatch to the New York Times saying they're making a big mistake. And the military censors stopped that dispatch and said, okay, you don't have to send it, we're releasing him. So I left the country as quick as I could. And then the next time I visited Bolivia was early this year to celebrate Evo Morales's election victory and participate in a conference in Cochabamba.
Yeah. Well, you know, your new book, Pirates of the Caribbean, is about this extraordinary transformation going on in Latin American politics. Really, I think I won't say unanticipated, but somewhat of a surprise, I think, politically around the world, and certainly the eyes of the world are upon it. So I want to talk about that. But before we do, let's stick in the 60s if we can for a while, because I think that, like we were saying at the beginning of the show, that gives a perspective on what you're writing about today. When you were in Bolivia, this is, for the sake of some of our younger listeners who might not know this history, Che Guevara, an Argentinian, had been instrumental in the Cuban Revolution, and then had decided at some point around 1966 or so to go to Bolivia as the poorest country, one of the most oppressive countries in the heart of Latin America, and participate and lead an uprising of the peasantry. And that's what you went to sort of follow, chronicle this, you know, bold move, to put it mildly.
Well, that is what we went to do. And Che Guevara, one has to understand, was first and foremost an internationalist, like many people were in those days. He didn't owe his loyalty to a country, but to a cause. And the cause was the liberation of humanity, as he used to put it. And even before he went to Bolivia, he'd gone to Africa after the murder of Patrice Lumumba by the CIA in that country, because they were fearful that Patrice Lumumba, the first popular elected leader of the Congo, was pro-communist. So they had him bumped off, and a right-wing regime took over in the Congo, and the Cuban leadership said, we've got to help these guys. Mm-hmm. So it was a real act of internationalism. Che was very despairing of the Congo, as his diaries prove. And then subsequently he went to Bolivia, because not only was it a poor, oppressed country under a military regime, it also had a long, long tradition of popular uprisings and revolutions. So he thought, wrongly, as it turned out, that something could be triggered off by exemplary actions in the countryside and the mountains. And this didn't happen. He was isolated rather easily because the United States found out he was there. And so they isolated him. A U.S. command post was set up in Cochabamba, and they finally killed him.
And that was, he was only at that point in his early 40s, is that right?
How old was Che when he died in 67? I think he might even have been in his late 30s. You know, I can't remember.
It reminds us just how often social change is a young person's game. And right. It's something that students today, when I talk to them about the 60s, remind them that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, who appear like ancient figures to them, were both in their 30s when they died. That the leading activists for the civil rights movement against the war, for almost every cause that people know about in the 1960s and the 70s, were people in their 20s, sometimes in their late teens.
You know, Bob, I met Malcolm when he came. I was a student at Oxford, and Malcolm was invited to come and speak at the Oxford Union. A very sort of, you know, posh outfit. And he came to defend the motion that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Barry Goldwater's
motion. But yeah. Malcolm defended it. Mm-hmm. He said, moderation in the pursuit of liberty is no virtue. Mm-hmm. Malcolm made a brilliant speech defending it. And he'd come up to me before the debate because he, you know, I mean, I was just a student there and I was introduced to him. And he said, Tariq Ali, Muslim brother. So I said, well, Malcolm, culturally, yeah, but otherwise I'm an atheist. And he said, you are what? So I told him. And so he was amused and chuckled. And after the debate was over, we went back to his hotel and talked till midnight. Mm-hmm. And he told me his story, and I said to him that, you know, in the United States, being a Muslim and converting and all that becomes part of your identity, but it doesn't help if you live in a Muslim country where everyone else is a Muslim too. And he said, you know something? I've just been visiting the Arab world, and lots of people have said that to me. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I'm not surprised, because it's not a big deal for us. And he said, anyway, we were talking, and we had a very nice evening, and I've described this in Street Fighting Years. And at the end of it, as I was about to leave, he stood up and we hugged each other. And I said, it's been really great, great talking to you, and I hope we meet up again soon. And he said, I don't think we will. And I said, excuse me? He said, oh, I think they're going to kill me very soon. So we just both, I sat down again and just stared at him. And at that moment, a thought goes through your mind. Could this guy possibly be serious? Is he so important?
Mm-hmm.
And Malcolm said very, very plainly to me, they're not going to let me live. And I said, why? He said, because I'm doing things they don't like. I am now saying that we need unity between the blacks and the whites in the United States to fight the system, and they don't like that. It's fine if you're just a black and organized within the black communities, but if you actually begin to suggest that what is vital is to unite the blacks and the whites against the system, they don't like it. So I said, still doubtful. So I said, Malcolm, who is going to kill you? He said, either the Nation of Islam or the U.S. state or one of its agencies or both. And, you know, I was shaken. And I really didn't believe him. I said he's being a bit paranoid, to be honest. You know, we were very young. We couldn't believe that someone could do this.
Yeah.
So we just embraced each other, and I went back. I told my friends, this is what Malcolm said, and they said, ah, oh, he's being paranoid. And then the very next year, this was November 1964, I think.
Yeah.
And then in February 65, I opened The Guardian, and there it was on the front page, Malcolm X assassinated. And I really went into a deep state of depression that day.
You know, it also recalls to me that just two or three years later, you know, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And what oftentimes has been lost in sort of the hagiography around Martin Luther King when we made it a national holiday in the United States is that in the last year or two of his life, he became probably the two defining features of his work was as a critic of U.S. imperialism and militarism in the war in Vietnam, and also calling for a cross-class alliance of poor people against the system. I mean, those were the, I mean, he was not just let's eat lunch, not simply a civil rights leader in the sense we recall him from the early 60s as he's remembered.
Absolutely right. And he changed quite sharply, become a severe critic of the Vietnam War, and wasn't he about to support the candidature of Dr. Spock? Or I can't quite remember.
I can't recall it, but it certainly would have been. It was the politics he was espousing were the same as Spock's at that time.
Yeah, he had decided that there was no hope or future in the Democratic Party, basically, given this was the party waging the war.
How ironic, the Democratic Party of 1968 looks like the Socialist Worker Party compared to the Democratic Party today.
It's absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I remember Martin Luther King's statement that it was a, you know, shock to discover that the greatest purveyor of violence in the world was the country to which I belonged, or words to that effect. And I think from that point on, many people now say, and books have been written, that a decision was taken to get rid of him. So the two most gifted Afro-American leaders, the minute they break out of the ghetto and become national leaders or are on that trajectory, are just assassinated. It's quite shocking, right?
Indeed. Our guest today, Tariq Ali, playwright, author, historian, journalist, political activist, and actor, author most recently of Pirates of the Caribbean. What's the subtitle for that book again?
Axis of Hope.
Axis of Hope, which is about the extraordinary political transformation taking place across South America and Latin America. Author of many other books, countless books, please go to the computer and enter Tariq Ali into the word search, and you will come across an extraordinary career going back to the 1960s, which we've been talking about here, which you've chronicled in your memoir, Street Fighting Years. And I think, you know, you were right there in London, in the UK, but also, as you point out, I think more than anyone, it was a global phenomenon, and it was not an American phenomenon by any stretch, or a Western phenomenon. And maybe you could just talk about some of the misnomers or misconceptions people have tended to have about the 1960s, and from your experience, what the real lessons were there.
Well, I mean, if you read some of the books, all that the 60s was about was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And the politics of the 60s, for some people, was either marginal or irrelevant. This is not true.
You did to get laid.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's totally not the case. Politics was very important to that period. And hundreds of thousands of young people in the United States were breaking with traditional party politics because it's the Democrats who were waging the war, and clearly they weren't going to go to the Republicans. And so the SDS was formed, the Students for a Democratic Society, mm-hmm. on almost every campus. Big, big tragedy is here, Bob, I feel, that there were so many gifted young people, incredibly intelligent, beginning to educate themselves, reading a phenomenal amount. Many of them were like walking encyclopedias, the mm-hmm. knowledge that they had accumulated. And basically, they imploded. They got impatient. You had the fights, crazed faction fights. Mm-hmm. Then you had the breakup of the SDS, the Weather People emerged, believing that small groups of people carrying out acts of violence against property or institutions could do the trick. And I did feel that much of that experience was wasted, whereas if all those people, or not all, let's say even 95% of them, had put their energies into developing a third force in U.S. politics, a third party, challenging the stranglehold, we might have been in a different situation today. You know, it's a real, real tragedy that.
I recall that period well. I came of age in the early 1970s, but was strongly influenced by the 60s, sort of as you couldn't help but be immersed in the politics of the 60s if you were a teenager, mm-hmm. as I was. And, you know, one of the things that was striking then is the notion of socialism and Marxism. Mm. Two terms that in the United States are increasing. I mean, they've never been embraced. But certainly today, the notion of socialism and Marxism are two failed concepts, completely irrelevant to the human condition. And anyone who espouses them or even considers them seriously is someone who you can instantly identify as completely out of touch with the world, and if they have any power, quite dangerous. That wasn't how it was perceived in this country or worldwide in 1968.
No, far from it. Socialism and Marxism were perceived as very potent ideas. And ideas that would help us map a better future and create a better society without social injustice, without exploitation. That was the way we looked at it. And our generation, by and large, was very critical of the experiments, so-called socialist experiment, that had happened in the Soviet Union, because that, we felt, was not socialism, that this was something that had become very debased and degenerate and was actually doing the socialist, communist, Marxist cause, whatever you want to call it, a great deal of harm. But this view, which, you know, was quite predominant actually in the SDS in the United States and in groups all over the world, never quite made it, because in Europe the communist parties remained quite strong. Then they began to move away from that. But instead of espousing a form of struggle that was more democratic and would lead to socialism, they began to move rapidly to the right. Which then, you know, the evolution is now complete.
I mean, the communist parties in Europe you're talking about, or the...
The communist parties in Europe. The communist party in the United States was largely irrelevant,
yeah.
If they'll forgive me no, saying
I
so.
I mean, all five members will forgive you.
Well, all five real members, I hope, yeah. will forgive me. The agents who had to infiltrate that party must have sort of odd memories of it. It'd be interesting if some of the FBI agents who infiltrated these organizations wrote their memoirs, just how they perceived it. It would just psychologically be of some interest, especially to me as a novelist. I'd just like to know how they...
I agree. It really would be.
It really would be.
Especially because the majority of the party in the 1950s were infiltrators.
It's quite astonishing.
I wonder if they knew they were each infiltrators or how that... If they winked at each other or...
It probably...
It'd make a good novel.
It would make a good novel, actually. Probably... Each infiltrator was kept secret from the other.
I would think so.
That's how they did it. You know, that's what the basis of spying is, that you don't let the other spy know you're a spy. And because, you know, just in case you make a mistake and the people you're spying on find you out. And the other characteristic of some of these spies inside the left parties was that they were more loyal than the party leadership themselves, just to prove their loyalty. So I bet you that some of the most hardline pro-Soviet elements in the CPUSA were probably FBI agents.
I think that's a safe bet from what I know of infiltrators in general. Our guest today on Media Matters is Tariq Ali, joining us today. We're recording this show a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't call in today. Let us sit back and do all the talking for you. I hope you enjoy the show. Tariq Ali is the author of countless books, and I have to say countless in his 40-year career as an author. Most recently, Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, published by Verso. Just last year, 2006. A book that I think is safe to say is generating a lot of attention and a claim. And we want to talk about that. We're going to talk about Latin American politics today. We're going to talk, that's sort of the hopeful side, the axis of hope. And then we'll also talk a little bit more about the other side of the coin, axis of not as much hope, the United States and Western Europe and the politics there. I just want to close up on the 60s, though, again, still. How, in retrospect, how realistic was the idea that we could have changed the world? I mean, had a revolutionary change. There was May 1968 in France, which seems like this anomaly in a way. How could you, in a period of great economic growth and expansion, have a social revolution? Doesn't that go against every, you know, sociological or political canon?
I don't think so, because I think Marx and some of the people within that tradition did argue that in order to make a revolution, you would have to have an advanced society. And a society in which the population or the working class and its allies had the leisure to actually think about their future. And, you know, when you're in a, when there's a massive depression or a slump, the only thing you want to think about is how you're going to get 2 meals a day. So the fact that you had full employment in France, the fact that there'd been a massive expansion of the university population created this strange atmosphere where people said, we don't like living in this society anymore. And, you know, the general strike that erupted in France in June 1968 was the largest general strike in the history of capitalism. 10 million French workers went on strike, and many of them were occupying their factories. And when the Communist Party trade union bureaucrats would go in and say, we've just negotiated a 25% wage increase with the bosses, they'd be met with catcalls and whistles. And at one big factory, I think it was the Renault car plant in France, I remember this very well, the trade union leader, exasperated, because they were basically trying to calm the situation down, said to the workers, I've got you this wage increase, what else do you want? And they said, we want the factory. They had, you know, there was that mood in the air. We can run this system better than the people who are running it because we actually know how it works. And that had a massive impact on consciousness. You had factory occupations which went on for ages, and finally the movement fizzled out. But its impact stayed to this very day. I mean, you know, and so it came close. De Gaulle, General De Gaulle, who was the president of France, actually flew to Baden-Baden in Germany to appeal to the hardcore French military based in Baden-Baden and said, things are getting out of control in Paris. If we lose Paris, I want your pledge that you will come and help me take it back again.
It sounds like 1870 or something.
It really was a bit like that. You know, they were extremely worried. And then, Bob, some years later. I say the period which opened up in 68 ended in 1975, where you had the revolution in Portugal, which came very close to being a socialist revolution.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is a period I remember well. And I think a lot of people don't realize that coming out of the Salazar dictatorship, the fascist regime in Portugal, sort of parallel to the Franco fascist regime neighboring Spain, the response in Portugal was... Please explain it, because it's been lost, I think, and through the cracks of history in the United States.
I know. Well, what happened in Portugal was you had a 50-year-old fascist dictatorship backed by the West, and you had a military high command which was engaged in fighting colonial wars in Mozambique, Guinea, and Angola, the Portuguese colonies in Africa. And they knew they weren't winning these wars, and gradually the younger officers began to get infected by the ideas of the people who they were fighting. And these were ideas of guerrilla warfare coming from Che Guevara, coming from Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, Vo Nguyen Gap, the legendary Vietnamese general. And the soldiers, Portuguese and the people they were fighting, would listen on their radio, transistor radios, to news coming from the battlefields in Vietnam saying the United States are being defeated. This had a mega impact on consciousness. And when these soldiers were called back home, they were the ones who led the charge for democracy. It was a soldiers' revolution, and then the people came and joined them. The images you see from Portugal are truly wonderful. You know, thousands of soldiers, arms linked with the population. Some of the most cogent thinkers of that movement came from within the officer corps. Otelo Carvalho, later arrested for fomenting insurrection. Melo Antunes, extremely intelligent and capable leader of the Portuguese Revolution. And the big mistake that was made by the far left in Portugal was not understanding that when you are getting rid of a dictatorship, what the people are really thirsty for is democracy. Mm-hmm. So the hardcore, ultra-Stalinist Portuguese Communist Party defended the idea of a dictatorship of the proletariat, whereas the Social Democrats said, Mário Soares, the socialist leader, would get up and say to the people, do we want socialism? They would say, yes. Do we want to take over the factories, the farms, and return them to the people? They would say, yes. But do we want democracy? Yes. And this the far left had no answer for. Mm-hmm. And they were totally outmaneuvered. Nonetheless, it was a very, very major event, the overthrow of fascism in Portugal. And it shouldn't be underrated.
And Tariq Ali, our guest, as I said, I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. We're about halfway through the show. We recorded this a couple weeks before going on air, so please sit back, relax, listen, let us do the talking. Tariq Ali is the author of many books, most recently Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope. And I think this is a good point, I think, to move forward from especially the Portugal comparison to Venezuela, because here again you have a similar situation. And to put preface this by saying that the 1970s and 1980s in Latin America was a period of extraordinary reaction. Almost every major country was a military dictatorship. Argentina, Uruguay, Chile having some of the worst human rights records in the world for that period. Not that's an honor any region or country wants to hold. And I think that many people thought going into the 1990s it was a region that was going to become purely an American commercial appendage. And the democracy, if it existed, would be tepid, American style, not especially participatory. And then in the last decade, there have been extraordinary changes, I think led first and foremost by Venezuela. But I'd like to hear your take on Latin America.
Well, I agree with you on that, Bob. And I think, you know, lots of people in the United States think, and I can't blame them, that the first big public manifestation against global injustice and against the rule of the corporations came in Seattle. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think that. In reality, the first big uprising against the IMF and the global institutions of capital came in Venezuela in 1989, where a social democratic government implemented IMF policies. cut subsidies to the poor, and the poor rebelled. You had an insurrection in Caracas, which is now known as the Caracazo.
Mm-hmm.
All the neighboring regions came out, and the Social Democratic government called out the military and told them to control the situation, and 3,000 people were shot dead. 3,000! Buried some of them in mass graves. And that event went very deep. In my opinion, it was the killing of these people which finished the old oligarchic parties in Venezuela forever. Simultaneously, it created real anger among some of the more progressive younger officers in the military. And Hugo Chavez describes how they began to organize and establish links with the trade unions, and they wanted to organize a rebellion where the unions would organize a general strike and progressive military leaders would come out in support of them and change the government, a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
The military the young officers carried out their side of the bargain. The unions couldn't do it. The defeat was too recent.
Mm-hmm.
So Chavez was arrested, and he asked the government, he told the government, "I plead guilty. Yeah, I did this. And I'm prepared to accept responsibility in front of the people. If you allow me to broadcast to the nation, I'll tell them." Astonishingly, they allowed him to do so. So he went on television and said, "My name is Hugo Chavez. I'm a commando unit major. And this is what we did. This is why we did it. And I apologize to you for our failure that we failed. And I am responsible for the failure because I misjudged the situation and thought people would come out. But they didn't. But we wanted to get rid of a government that had killed our people. And I didn't want the military ever to be used again to kill the people." That's what he said on television. They locked him up for 6 months, but his popularity shot up. You know, mm-hmm. opinion polls showed 70% of the population supported him. So when he stood for president in 1999, he won.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been winning ever since. And one reason he's been winning is because he's using the oil wealth of Venezuela to do what? To build schools, free schools for the poor, university education for kids from poor families who can't afford it. That's happening. Free health service, the basis of which has been laid. Land reforms, housing, interest-free loans to small businesses, which he had pledged. And he's one of the first politicians in this age to carry out his pledges. And that has triggered off. I mean, Venezuela immediately became a pole of attraction for the whole of the continent, followed by Bolivia, followed by Ecuador. And people who had assumed in the West, including many people who once were progressive and then moved to the right, that nothing was possible now, became some of the most virulent critics of the process because it challenged the life decision that they had made. So mm-hmm. you had the most ferocious attacks on Chavez by liberals because they couldn't take what he was doing because they had thought none of this was possible any longer. So that is what Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, tries to explain and underline. Axis of Hope, because once again, these changes have given hope not just to Latin America, but to the whole world, including sections of the Hispanic population in the United States, including people elsewhere in the world who'd given up. But now they feel if the Latin Americans are beginning to do it, so can we.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed here in the United States is the press coverage does not give the same picture of Latin America and Venezuela as I just got from you in your description. And as you pointed out, even on The Daily Show, which is sort of a liberal comedy show here, Chavez was ridiculed and put down as sort of a tin horn thug. And I think, you know, Thomas Friedman has lumped him together at times, and other commentators have sort of routinely with North Korea and various other unsavory governments that hardly respect the rule of law. And the impression is that this is just some guy who is, if not a dictator now, is just angling for the moment to sort of put his statue up and rename the capital city after himself. You've been to Venezuela. Is your sense that the press coverage of Chavez is as I've described it in Europe and the United States, or how have you seen it? And then what's the reality you see in Venezuela?
Well, this is certainly the way the press has been treating Chavez, not just in the United States, but all over Europe. I mean, a majority of newspapers have had exactly the same view. This is a political leader who has been elected with increasing majorities on 7 different occasions. Yet they call him authoritarian. Why? He's actually deepened democracy. He's given Venezuela a constitution which allows the population to call for a recall of the president if they get so many signatures. And his enemies actually, well, he, we think, forged the signatures, but he said, fine, never mind, let's not fight about whether the signatures were forged or faked. Let's have the recall vote. There was a referendum. He won it. Jimmy Carter, who went from the Carter Center to observe the Venezuelan election, said these are the freest elections I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And one assumes he was talking about the United States as well when he made that statement.
And it's a safe statement.
It's a safe statement. So, I mean, the fact that Chavez is hated has got very little to do with his so-called authoritarianism, but everything to do with the fact that he offers a challenge to the neoliberal capitalist system and says the state has a role to play and must play that role to create a social safety net for its underprivileged citizens. And the support for Chavez comes mainly from the poor. So it's true that they hate him, but that has very little impact. But, you know, Bob, it's worth remembering that when Chavez made that speech denouncing George W. at the United Nations, he also did something else. He lifted up a book by Noam Chomsky, read a paragraph from it, and advised American citizens to go and read it. Within 3 days, Noam's book was top of the Amazon bestseller list and had reached the New York Times bestseller list. So people, even in the States, were listening to this guy. And that does happen all over the world because there are very few political leaders like that who are prepared to say what they think.
And we have in Latin America now, in Ecuador and Bolivia, to a certain extent in Argentina, governments that are sort of following along a similar course to what Chavez has pioneered. How prevalent do you think this movement is? Is it going to be a continent-wide or even arguably globally?
Well, I think it needs to win over Brazil and it needs to secure Argentina. And were it to do that, it would become irresistible. And the tragedy is that in Brazil, in Chile, you have governments of, of leaders belonging to left parties who have accepted the Washington Consensus.
And for listeners of ours unfamiliar with what the Washington Consensus means, you're referring to?
The Washington Consensus means the set of policies agreed to by the U.S. Treasury Department, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, and all the European governments and the G8 leaders, deciding on the pattern capitalism was to follow, markets were to be the only real denominator, privatizations, deregulation.
Foreign ownership being permitted and encouraged.
Yes. No challenges to foreign capital being permitted or allowed. All this is what is known as the Washington Consensus. And this consensus was challenged first by the Venezuelans, now by the Bolivians, then by the Ecuadorians, partially by the Argentinians, but never by the Brazilians or the Chileans.
And what's ironic about that, and I don't have to tell you, but our listeners should know, I mean, the president of Brazil, Lula, came from the Workers' Party, which was a party which was a grassroots party of poor people in Brazil, specifically emerged to challenge precisely neoliberalism and this vision of the world. And when it did finally win election and assume power, it was assumed it would move in a direction not unlike what Chavez has done, but it hasn't.
It hasn't, and Lula and his chief advisors, many of whom were ex-members of left groups, his finance minister, his first finance minister, Palocci, was an ex-Trotskyist. And these people took some of their dogma from their days as left-wing people. Now they became dogmatic defenders of the Washington Consensus. Their character, their psychology didn't change, but their politics did. And they said this is the only way, there is no alternative. They kept stressing that. There is no alternative, we have to go down this route. But the alternative was there, staring them at the face. Chavez's Bolivarian politics, Chavez's attempts to unite the continent in its and defend its own interests, they were very nervous about. The attacks on Chavez in the Brazilian media, corporate-owned Brazilian media, are just as bad, if not worse sometimes, than those in the Western media. And Lula has turned out to be a very big disappointment. Corruption is rife. His own close associates have been accused of corruption. And the only reason he was re-elected is because no one wanted to see the sort of hard right back in power again. But from the point of view of the Brazilian population, it's been an absolute tragedy. I mean, he's, you know, I've described him in Brazil as a tropical version of Tony Blair.
Not a compliment, I might say. The United States has made it clear it's not in favor of the Chavez regime. It's now clear it supported and assisted in the 2002 attempt to overthrow him by the Venezuelan military, those elements of it that were sympathetic to the United States and hostile to Chavez. But currently, the United States, which I don't think is also excited about what's going on in Bolivia or Ecuador, it seems to have its hands tied. I mean, it seems to be unable to, its options appear to be limited. How much of this is due to the fact that there's so much popular support in Latin America, it's simply they're scared? And how much is due to the fact that because of being tied down to the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan and having just all the resources of the military in this sort of sinkholes over there, that it really, it can only just pound its chest, but it really doesn't have the resources to overthrow these regimes.
I think that's true. I think it's a combination of the two. One is that all the leading U.S. policymakers, their strategic thinkers, the Pentagon, are heavily engaged in two wars, both of which are going badly wrong, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And they really don't have that much time to develop and think strategically about their own backyard. That is one reason. But principally, Bob, you have to look at it like this. In the old days, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the solution in Latin America was simple. When there were politicians who were, you thought were misbehaving, you organized a military takeover in that country.
Killed them.
And killed them.
Shouldn't be laughing. Actually.
I know, but that's what they did. That's what they did to Salvador Allende in Chile on 9/11/1973. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did, in many parts of Latin America, take over via the military and implant torturers at the heart of the system. But it's not easy to do that any longer because the people are awakened. You have mass mobilizations in all these countries. And it's an open question of how many militaries in Latin America would be prepared to do this for the United States any longer. I mean, some would, but I think the military would split now because the situation has changed very drastically. So the other alternative is direct intervention. That's impossible at the moment. The U.S. just doesn't have the manpower to do it. The third alternative is to get a rogue regime on your side and encourage them to do the business.
Invade like, some other countries.
Invade some other countries.
Liberate them.
Yeah. One such country would have been Colombia. And Plan Colombia saw a massive amount of money given to this regime. But they're very heavily dependent on trade with Venezuela. And just, some weeks ago, Chavez and Uribe, though they disagree fundamentally with each other, signed a trade pact. Mm-hmm. And Uribe, the Colombian president, totally in the pocket of the United States, has said in public, we will never be used to rag Venezuela, because he knows if he did that, it would break up his own country. So it's not an easy thing for them to topple these governments anymore. And if they did in Bolivia, it would create a very ugly situation, probably leading to a protracted civil war.
Our guest, Tariq Ali, we only have about 7, 8, 9 minutes left in the show. So thank you for being patient and joining us today. Remember, you can't call in. This is a recorded show. We're going on air a couple of weeks after we recorded this program. While Tariq Ali was in the United States on a speaking tour, talking about his new book, Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, and his other work, his long and, in my view, extraordinarily distinguished career. Tariq Ali, you also write at length about international politics and also the Middle East, which is clearly a center of political conflict and stress in the world for our lifetimes, particularly today more than ever. And one thing that's interesting, you mentioned how Chavez has taken the oil wealth. And let me preface this by saying, I remember once reading a U.S. report with no sense of irony, a U.S. official was talking about the difficulty of getting rid of Chavez. They said, it's not fair. You know, he's using all this money to buy off the people. He's using the oil revenues. He's buying off people with, you know, giving them the money. No wonder we're having trouble getting rid of the guy. Like, you know, if he only kept all the money like these other oil countries, you know, then it would be easier to get rid of him. And they said that, as I said, without any irony whatsoever. But, I mean, you look at the other oil-rich countries, be it in Nigeria and Africa, but especially in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Iran and Iraq, and countries or Kuwait, where this vast wealth is being generated. You know, we oftentimes in the United States view the Islamic world as a monolith, not even the Arab world, just Iran and Pakistan just thrown in together. And don't understand, these are very complex societies, too. And is there popular movements in countries like these say maybe that Chavez has an interesting idea here? We should take the wealth we're generating and not just simply buy lavish summer homes for the leaders in France, but apply the money to our own people.
Well, it's very interesting you ask that, Bob, because a few years ago, Chavez made a trip to the Middle East for an oil-producing conference, an OPEC conference. While he was there, Al Jazeera, the television most popular television network in the Arab world, interviewed him for 1 hour, and instead of putting subtitles, which they never use, they put an Arab voiceover on him. 36 million people all over the Arab world watch this program. And the producer told me when I was next in town, he said we had tens of thousands of emails following that interview. And we almost had to hire special people to answer and acknowledge those emails. I said, what did they say? He said, 95% of these emails, if not more, in one way or the other, ask the question, when will the Arab world produce a Chavez? So, and the reason for that was not his attacks on U.S. foreign policy, but mm-hmm. the fact that people were really impressed when he described what Venezuela was doing with its oil wealth. Because there is enough oil in these Arab countries to educate the entire Islamic world free, at higher university level and postgraduate level, but they do not do it. They do not do it, nor does the U.S. encourage them to do it, because the U.S. has always preferred authoritarian governments and dictatorships and corrupt feudal-type monarchies to control the oil, because it's easier to deal with them. Whereas when the people control the oil, as they do in Venezuela, it's difficult to control it. And as the people once did in Iran, a democratic government in 1953, they toppled it, which gave us first the Shah's regime, a torturous regime, and finally the clerics, because all left and secular alternatives had been destroyed.
We're now in the fourth or fifth year of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, now appearing by both political parties in this country as something that will not be ending of U.S. volition, at least, for another 4 or 5 years. Afghanistan appears to be pretty much the same. There's some discussion and some agreement that the U.S. has an obligation to do something about the country between them, Iran, a nation of 70 million people, a much larger, more developed nation than either Iraq by the time we invaded it, or Afghanistan. The first two wars we've already talked about are unmitigated disasters by all accounts.
Yeah.
Do you think that the United States could actually do something toward Iran in view of the resource stretch we've seen? And whether it does it or not, what is going to be the legacy ultimately for the world of these U.S. invasions?
Well, the first point to make is that in Afghanistan, they are so desperate now that the puppet regime they installed in Kabul is so isolated that they are pleading with factions of the Taliban, who they once described as the most evil people in the world, to join the coalition government in Kabul and help them out. And the Taliban are now saying to them, are replying to Hamid Karzai, the U.S. puppet, we are prepared to talk business with you, but only once all foreign troops have left the country. They are angered by this response and are now trying to split the Taliban, saying, well, some of you should join us now. Maybe the others can join us after foreign troops has left, because Karzai knows he can't last without NATO troops protecting him. As far as Iran is concerned, Bob, I've been one of those saying that even if some sort of nutty right-wing politicians in the administration, by which I mean Cheney and gang, want a last-minute bombing raid on Iran before they go as their final legacy to the world, I don't think the military is going to buy that one, because any attack on Iran would endanger the lives of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, because that's where the Iranians would hit back very, very quickly by telling their people in Iraq and Afghanistan, okay, the gloves are off, go for it. So from that point of view, it would be crazy. As for destabilizing the country and that whole region even more, it's something that is even it's not even worth considering, because Iran has nuclear reactors spread all over the country. It's not just one location. So if they're going to bomb all of them, it means an act of war. And to declare war, whether you declare it or not, but an act of war against Iran will lead to absolute chaos, and the United States will never get out of there in one piece.
And even if that doesn't take place, just looking at what's going on in Iraq today, and combined with Afghanistan, where does this, I mean, it just seems, where is this going, in your view?
Well, in my opinion, in Afghanistan, the only solution is a withdrawal of all NATO troops, and all the regional powers who have influence in that part of the in Afghanistan, which means Iran, Pakistan, Russia, and India, to sit down together, the regional powers, and say, we have to have a national government, give it a five-year breathing space, after which elections to a constituent assembly. No war for 5 years, massive social reconstruction. That's the way. In Iraq now, they've virtually divided the country. Northern Iraq is an Israeli-American protectorate. Southern Iraq is essentially an Iranian protectorate, and Middle Iraq there is an American protectorate, but they want it to be a Saudi protectorate. Whether the Iraqi parties can rise above all this and maintain the unity of the country is in itself an open question. Meanwhile, the Turkish armies on the border with northern Iraq are poised to go in and sort out their own troublesome Kurds. So it's a totally chaotic situation, which a number of Pentagon generals warned the politicians would be a nightmare unless they had clear-cut political aims. They didn't, and it's proved to be a total disaster. The only thing they can do is get out, and I don't buy the argument, if we leave, there'll be a mess. There's a mess because you're in there. You know, a million Iraqis have died, 2 million refugees, numerous millions hurt, wounded, collapse of the country's social infrastructure, and it'll be a bigger mess if you pull out. Give us a break.
Tariq Ali, we've only got about a minute left, but I think this leads to sort of a question that is a life's work type question. There's no easy answer, but it's, I think it logically follows our discussion. Are we at a moment when the United States, you know, its role in the world is shrinking economically? It's a much smaller economic power on one hand, but it still has the military of Rome, so to speak, a much in greater power than its economic power or political influence any longer, and that we're sort of dealing with this tension going forward.
That is absolutely right, in my opinion. China, I think the 21st century will be remembered for the rise of China, China becoming the workshop of the world, China outdistancing its rivals, the decline of U.S. economic power, and the attempt by the U.S. to make up for that decline through military interventions, preserving its hegemony not economically, politically, or ideologically, but largely through military interventions. This is what the 21st century has started off being, and I think it will end with this being resolved one way or the other. And in my opinion, Bob, a lot will depend on the American people, not their politicians, but the capacity of the American people to create something different.
On that note, I want to thank Tariq Ali for being my guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for engineering the show. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thank you all very much.